Rob Henderson's life story is out of a movie. He never knew his father, was abandoned by his mother as a toddler, grew up in the foster care system in 10 different homes where he faced abuse, neglect, and early substance abuse issues. But defying the odds, he turned his life around and eventually graduated as a Cambridge PhD. He's since created one of the most viral ideas in sociology, where he's now become well known for his idea of luxury beliefs, the idea that the rich signal status through positions like defund the police or marriage isn't important, and those positions actually hurt the poor. We chat about Rob's life and what he has learned from such an incredible story. There was one line that stuck with me. I'm going to not get it right, but like, if I'd felt everything that happened to me, I would have started taking hostages or something worse. And so, yeah, how, like, you get this flood of overwhelming experiences. Mm-hmm. What were the primary coping mechanisms? And I know they evolved over the course of your life as you get access to, for instance, alcohol. You know?
Yeah, of course it changes based on your environment and who's around you and what, you know, material resources mm-hmm. and, you know, what avenues you can take. So early on, you know, how did it express itself? I mean, you know, I think part of it was this sort of anger toward adults and, mm-hmm. or intentionally neglecting schoolwork, you know, this feeling of, okay, well, I just changed schools again. I just changed homes again. And like, why would I do this? Like, mm-hmm. who cares? No one really seems to care if I do this. So why should I? And so there was that kind of oppositional attitude that I had once I started school. And then, yeah, like a lot of the neighborhoods that I was in, you know, there were other kids from, you know, deprived or dysfunctional backgrounds. And so I'd make friends with them and get into fights or steal, and, you know, get into little misadventures. Then later, well, so I do tell a story when I was in one of the foster homes. You know, there was this, like they had a group of teenage guys. Some of them were foster kids. Some of them were part of the family. And they all hung out in the garage. These were like teenagers, maybe some guys in their early 20s. And they'd always just like sort of drink beer, kick back, listen to music. And so when I was 5, I wandered into this garage and like I found this little glass. It looked like it was apple juice. And I drank it and it turned out to be beer. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it tasted disgusting.
I found a little can and was like, this is gross.
But these guys were like, you know, they didn't care. They kind of thought it was funny, this little kid drinking the beer. And like, you know, the foster parents were kind of checked out. They didn't pay attention. And so, and they encouraged me. And that was like a moment where I was receiving like positive feedback from these cool guys, you know, cool guys. Yeah. And I'm this little boy and I'm like, oh, these guys like me when I drink this beer. Mm. And so, you know, that created this association in my mind of like drinking is cool. People will like me if I drink. And then by the time I was 9, hanging out with my other 9-year-old friends, we would. So one of my friends, he had a single mom. She had a liquor cabinet full of tequila and other stuff. And we would sneak into her cabinet and drink tequila. And we'd like refill it with water, trying to like match the level it was before. We would go to the local gas station and buy cold medicine. Wow. And this was the late 90s, early 2000s. So like things were a little bit more relaxed in terms of like sales to minors for medication and stuff, like over the counter stuff. So we would go and buy like, Robitussin or I don't know, whatever, like Benadryl or DXM and just sort of take these pills and see like how we would feel. Wow. And then, I had a friend who had an older cousin who could hook us up with generic Vicodin, cigarettes, weed, another friend. His parents were foster parents, so they were his biological parents. He had a mom and a stepdad, but they had a bunch of foster kids living with them. And he had an older foster brother who was a drug dealer, so he could get us weed. Sometimes he would try to get us to smoke meth. We declined, at least I declined. I don't know, my friend, maybe later he got into it, but I didn't. And so, it was just a lot of drugs. And then later, drinking and driving and speeding and like violence, like fighting was this sort of temporary escape. Fighting was pervasive. You know, it's so funny. Like now, like I get up at whatever, if I have to get up for a flight or something and it's 6:30, 7 o'clock, I'm like, I need coffee. Like I need time to like get myself awake. But I'm thinking back, you know, like high school first period started at 8 o'clock, but you know, kids would show up at 7:30, 7:45. And we'd be like throwing down in front of the lockers at like 7:45. And like now I'm like the idea of getting into a fight at 7:45, like I don't think I would make it. Like I need at least a couple glasses of coffee first. I need to wake up. But, you know, if you're sort of 16, 17 and you drink a few Monster energy drinks and you have this chip on your shoulder and you also don't want to be seen as weak.
Yeah.
You know, there is that part of it, too, of you know, wanting to impress your other guy friends, and that becomes the sort of source of prestige and status, is like what your other stupid guy friends think of you, how tough you are and how badass you are. So
I was struck by that observation when I was reading, and I've thought it before, which is like societies need something to do with their 16 to 24 year old men. Yeah. Because if you don't have like a path and a structure or like a way for them to feel connected and integrated, the speed with which they will get into destructive to themselves and others activities. I was reminded, I was on the road, I'm in my lane. This 16-year-old, he must have been 16 or 17, in a BMW, comes ripping around the corner into the other lane, you know, just like, this is Malibu. And I was just like, man, I fucking hate young men.
Yeah, I have that feeling
like,
too. Yeah.
They're the worst. And yeah. I was one.
Yeah.
I fortunately like didn't make any catastrophic things, but like, I'm so curious. I guess there's a couple things. One is just that commentary. And I look at like college is like, oh my God, this is just like a zoo where you have to like put some of your young men. The military is for like some of the other young men have to go
and
there.
Prison, right?
Prison is another place for him. But like there just needs to be some like containment and structure. And God, it's seems like the military, given your upbringing, was such an important structure for you not having catastrophic decisions.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one wrong turn while you were drinking or one other thing could have completely transformed your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. And it's funny, like now I talk to people and they say like, yeah, but you were, you know, you're a smart guy. You probably would have figured it out. And I think like, it doesn't matter how smart you are. Like, yeah, exactly. If you had enough to drink and you're behind the wheel and you're 16 and you're an inexperienced driver, you know, like it doesn't matter. Like you're sort of academic inclination or level of smarts or whatever, like that's just it was just sheer luck, right? Because I did know a couple of kids who did die drinking and driving in my high school, and another who died drinking and texting, or no, driving and texting rather. And so
drinking and texting would be extreme.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that you definitely
don't. He regretted it so much that he just
that's one you really want to avoid. So, and I think on some level I understood the path I was on. I saw, you know, when I was in high school, I had two different jobs. I worked as a dishwasher at one point and then later as a bagger at a supermarket. And I had older male coworkers, guys in their early 20s, some in their as late as their early 30s. And, you know, I thought they were cool at first, you know, because these guys, you know, they whatever buy my friends and I beer or hook us up with cigarettes or whatever. And but then sometimes I would go to like high school parties. So I'm in high school, I'd go to high school parties, but every once in a while I'd see one of these guys at a high school party. I'm like, why is like a 24-year-old guy hanging out at a high school party? This is like, even I thought that was like pathetic, even as a 17-year-old kid. And I started to think, is that who I want to be when I'm 24? Is like working the same job I'm working now, going to the same kind of parties I'm going to now, whatever, getting paid on Friday and then just drinking away the weekend and showing up hungover Monday morning and like just living that cycle of kind of on the margins of society. Like it's one thing to be a dishwasher when you're 17, but when you're 27 and 37 doing that job, you know, it does seem to, like for me, it didn't look like a particularly happy life.
That extended time horizon is not common, especially for people in that circumstance. It's like the end of the week or the end of the thing. But to think from 17 to 24, is this where I want to be, is almost like an epiphany moment. Do you know why you experienced that and other people don't seem to?
I don't know, because it was like this epiphany, because I'd never really thought that way before. It may have just been like, it was my senior year of high school. I started to feel this anxiety about where I was going to go next. It may have also been, for reasons I explain in the book, like I didn't really have anywhere to go after high school. You know, I was living with my friend and his dad, and like, you know, my mom was in another town. And so there's just a lot of sort of family drama and chaos that I didn't know where I was going to live. And I started to think about the future more and where I would end up. And I think that may have been part of it. Whereas for a lot of my friends, maybe they weren't thinking as much about it because, you know, they could always just stay with their parents, right? At least for a little while longer. And I did have friends. I had one friend who lived with his dad until he was like, 26, 27. Yeah. And when you have that, yeah, maybe when you do have that kind of safety net or whatever in place, you don't necessarily have to, you don't have the same pressure on yourself to think about what's going to happen next. And so for me, it was like, yeah, I got to do something quick. I needed somewhere to live. I needed somewhere to stay. I needed a job.
And that got you thinking, where do I want to be after that? Well, how does that, interesting. Do you have a sense, and it's, this is like the $1 trillion question. Like, if you take all of the people in your circumstances with similar, let's say comorbidities that you had, only one of them would wind up at Oxford. Like only
Cambridge.
Only, Cambridge, sorry. Yeah. Only one of them would go, like in any sort of college.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense, both the internal and external things that pushed you to that circumstance, and so many of the other people wound up either in jail or just not making it out, or?
Yeah, it's hard. You know, there's that kind of survivorship bias. And so what made the difference? Well, okay. So I mentioned before, some people will tell me you were a smart guy. You were going to figure it out. Obviously. And I try to convey this in the book that I was always kind of a curious kid. I was the only one of my friends who read for pleasure. You know, I'd go to the school library and check out books. I would practice the math exercises in the textbook. I would do these kinds of things. Like once I started to realize that this was an enjoyable activity for me learning, you know, I wouldn't do the homework. Like, you know, again, I had that chip on my shoulder of, oh, if an adult tells me you got to do this, turn in your science project, I would just say, you know, fuck off. Like, I'm not doing that. But for myself, if I found it enjoyable, I would do it. But academic ability is, it's necessary, but not sufficient to do well. And so you can have a kid with all the talent in the world, underlying ability, but if you put them in a really horrible environment, it's not going to be able to express itself and manifest itself. Once I got out of that environment and joined the military and wasn't in an environment where I could express those parts of myself and cultivate those underlying abilities, and I had good mentorship and structure and predictability and all those kinds of things that I lacked when I was growing up, it was really, I mean, it was the opposite. I had like a very kind of free range childhood, like almost as free range as you can possibly imagine. And the military was the opposite, where every aspect of my life was tightly controlled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, day to day, it really sucked. I bristled at just how much everything was controlled. But on some level, I knew this was good for me. And I also knew that if I like failed out of it or couldn't make it, I would feel this kind of shame. And I also didn't know where I would go next. So I tried as hard as I could to make it. And I, you know, there were some blunders and setbacks and so on, but I still managed to do okay. And so I think that was really maybe the deciding factor, was almost this half impulsive decision at 17 to just enlist in the military. Now, granted, the reason I did that, and maybe, you know, this is something, this is kind of a lesson that can be more broadly applied, is I joined because of two older male figures in my life.
Yeah.
It would probably be overstating things to say they were role models, but these were two older men in my life that I respected and who I trusted had my best interests in mind. So one was my friend's father. I mentioned I lived with my friend and his dad and his brother my senior year of high school. And he was like he was a private investigator. He was almost never home, but I respected him. And he had been in the Air Force before. He was a veteran. And whenever he was around, he would tell me about, you know, this is an option for you. Like it helped me in my life. You know, he went from Air Force, he became a police officer, then private investigator. And so he was like a cool guy. You know, he had that kind of like vibe.
You also said, like, I think this is so important. You trusted that he had your best interest at heart, which we don't need to go into all the stories. You can read the book, but like that was not often the case with adults. So I think that's huge.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 I mean, yeah, I trusted that. Yeah. He wanted the best for me and of course for his sons. Even if he was an imperfect father, and I'm sure he had his own issues that he was dealing with. And my high school history teacher, and he was a male teacher. And, you know, when I look back on like my high school experiences and like I think about the kind of people in my life whose advice I learned, for whatever reason, they tended to be men more often than not, maybe because I was unconsciously longing for that kind of fatherly advice or paternal guidance that I didn't have from growing up without a father. But this high school history teacher, it was funny, like at first, you know, the first few weeks or whatever the semester, he would like kind of get on my case. Where's your homework? What's going on? Why didn't you bring your book or whatever? And then eventually, because he would tell me, like, you're a smart kid, like, what's going on? And then I think eventually he kind of just took this hands-off approach, like, this kid isn't going to listen to me. Eventually, he would just talk to me about anything.
Yeah.
He would just, like, we talk about sports or we talk about whatever. Like, sometimes he'd see me bring a book from the library and ask me about that. And I think he just, you know, tried to get to know me in a different way.
Terms.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then one day, you know, like halfway through the semester, he showed me this picture of himself in a military uniform. And he told me he had, you know, coincidentally enough, been in the Air Force too, and suggested this for me. He's like, you're a smart kid. I don't know what's going on in your life right now, but this could be a possibility for you. And so, you know, that's two guys now who tell me maybe the military. And so, yeah, I mean, that made it real for me.
Yeah.
You know, it made it like a real possibility that I knew two people who had done this. Maybe I could do it too.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I think as I think through, and I don't know that these are easy to create from a political perspective or to get people to do, but from a human perspective, the genuine concern for the person, and you described having, for instance, a foster parent who seemed to like collect young boys for chores, basically, which is not highly in their interest.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this, rather than trying to change an angry young 15 or 16 year old, letting go of it and just connecting with them on the terms that are available, establishing that sense of trust, and then making a suggestion. And that reminds me of when you would, you know, meet a new foster person. They're like, we're going to be with together and we're going to be a family now and it's going to be all great. It's like the amount of people that showed up and were like, it's going to be good, or try to get you to change and drop your guard immediately is just like, yeah, I'm not going to, no fucking way. Like, you're going to have to do some extra legwork to connect with someone who has had that sort of a background. And it seems, I don't know, just as I think through it, when I think through some of these angry kids and my perhaps immediate response is like, fuck that kid, you know, to be like, all right, can I, not that I encounter too many of them, but can I like slow down, find out what's going on in their life? What do they care about? Before trying to lecture them or change them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, that's such a, for many of them, that would be such a novel experience too, of just like any adult, just sort of slowing down and asking them what's going on.
Mm.
And it takes a while for that, like, sort of ice to thaw. And that's another thing about the military was like, you don't really have a choice, right? Like, you just have to do what people say, even if you don't want to, even if you have that sort of impulsive oppositional feeling of just like, you know, the consequences are so swift and made so clear up front. Yeah. And
you can work on your emotional issues in your book later.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like, you know, 8 years of that. So I enlisted for 4 years. I was 17, signed up for 4 years. First enlistment ended at 21. And even then I realized I wasn't ready yet for like the kind of freedom that civilian life would offer. And I didn't really have a plan either. I was still like kind of immature and unprepared even at 21. And so then I signed up for 4 more years. And then, by the time I was 25, as like that enlistment was winding down, I'm like, okay, I think I'm ready now. But it took a full 8 years of that sort of environment, experiences, personal and professional development, all those things that finally I felt ready. And so, you know, one way to look at this is like, you know, even for someone like me who was like a pretty bright kid who had a lot of difficulties early in my life, I still needed like 8 years of this sort of extreme environment and mentorship and like sort of forced to do these things that I didn't want to do over and over before finally I felt ready to, you know, be who I am now. And I don't know how like replicable that is. Like, one of the underlying points of my book is that, you know, we focus so much on what happens after the age of 18 for people of, okay, so this kid is poor. He grew up in a deprived, dysfunctional environment, but like, how do we get more kids into college now? How do we take this, this young guy who's, you know, maybe has some attitude issues or whatever and like make sure he's successful? But for me, I'm thinking, well, by that point, I don't want to say it's too late, but it's much harder at 18 versus if you go way, way earlier in his life and try to sort of find ways to improve the child's environment and how they're raised and how they feel about themselves and the attachment they have with their parents or caregivers. And then in a way, just sort of naturally through being raised by loving people who care about them, have their best interest in mind. By the time they reach 18, they're going to make better decisions anyway. And so I almost think, you know, are we looking at the wrong end of that sort of cutoff of adulthood? We should be looking earlier.
What do you have an idea of what sorts of like political or cultural interventions would be useful? Because if I think of somebody like a Ben Shapiro, he's going to go even earlier and be like, we need more religion so that we have more attached husband and wife things, so that even when things get tough, at least we have two parents. And you know what I mean? So like there's and then a more left-leaning person might say we need more Head Start programs to have stuff for these kids after school. Do you have a sense of what sort of interventions would be most effective?
Well, I describe a study in the preface of Troubled, and I've seen similar results elsewhere. So this does seem to be a replicated finding that when developmental psychologists, when they separate sort of two categories, childhood instability and childhood poverty. So poverty is basically like how your level of family income when you were a kid. Did you grow up poor? And does that predict certain kinds of life outcomes? So likelihood of incarceration, you know, risky behavior, drug seeking, teen pregnancy, those kinds of things. And researchers find very weak evidence that childhood poverty leads to those outcomes if you just sort of measure those directly. Some do, but it's very sort of weak, the correlation. But when researchers measure childhood instability and see the relationship between instability and those outcomes, it's much stronger. Mm. And instability is measured by things like you know, the questions it will ask you is, you know, how frequently did you relocate to different homes when you were a child? Were your parents married when you were born? Did they separate? How frequently did your primary caregiver, or how many romantic partners did your primary caregiver have when you were growing up? Yeah. How much sort of day-to-day disorder and drama there was in your daily life? How much uncertainty there was? And that has a strong and consistent and significant relationship with those negative life outcomes.
I see that out here in California, dude. But it's on the other way. So it's these very wealthy families who maybe get divorced.
Yeah.
And then the kid is enlisted in therapy at 3 years old, has a number of different nannies that raise him over the course of his life.
Yeah.
And is heavy into drugs. And what's interesting is there's very little like social media or cultural understanding of how somebody who has it all can have such a destructive experience. Exactly. And I think it's because we conflate what you're saying, which is we think poverty is the cause of all of these difficult feelings, which need to be repressed and then acted out later, when actually it's this, the core of it is instability.
Yeah. Especially early in life, that feeling of, because as a child, you know, these aren't conscious thoughts like, oh, I feel abandoned, oh, I feel neglected. It's like internal, like it's in your body that you feel it and you don't even understand it. And even if it never reaches the surface of your consciousness as an adult, like you still feel it in your body, right? And you don't even, you may not know what that is, that feeling. Mm. And I've seen this too, like seeing children of upper middle class parents who seemingly have it all. But there was maybe some, divorce, addiction, drama, abuse, neglect, something going on in their families and whatever. They ship the kid off to a bunch of boarding schools or what have you. And, you know, they have it all. And on paper, they look okay, but they have a lot of difficulty in their lives, their relationships. It doesn't look quite the same as like a poor kid in instability, right? Yeah. Because they're probably not going to go to prison, but they will have just a lot of personal difficulties, self-esteem, self-worth issues, all of those things. So all of this is to say that like, okay, yes, I agree that like, I'm not opposed to financial assistance for needy families. Mm-hmm. Like that's totally fine. If we can find ways to economically support single moms, single parents, family struggling, totally fine. But I do think like alongside that we could, I'm not a religious person. I'm skeptical of like politicians sort of introducing religion as like a lifestyle that Americans should adhere to. And it just feels, like too much like on encroaching on people's freedom somehow. But I do think like there are other ways to do it where you could, promote information, just give people the information and find ways to prize and confer status on good decisions. You don't necessarily need to stigmatize single parents or divorced parents, but you could sort of on the other side of that, pay tribute and lip service and whatever to, okay, here are two parents who are struggling, but they're married and they're making it work. Mm-hmm. And here are the steps that they're taking and here are the lessons. And if we could find ways to communicate those stories or, you know, public awareness campaigns, things like, you know, when a child is raised by two married parents, they're X percent more likely to graduate from high school or X percent less likely to drop out, those kinds of things. And, you know, I know inevitably people are going to suggest, oh, but like somehow it still is going to make single parents feel bad or something, or it's going to feel judgy. But I don't know if that's true. I think that just because you point out the advantages of one choice doesn't necessarily mean you're casting judgment or condemning people for making a different choice. You know, by analogy, I think most Americans would agree that like going to college is a good choice, getting a degree is a good choice. And we applaud people for getting an education, or if they stop their education but then continue it later, we applaud that and say that was a good thing you did. But no one ever says, oh, but when you applaud college graduates, you're casting judgment on those high school graduates who never went to college, or those blue collar workers who went to trade school, or, you know, you're making these other people feel bad. So let's just not make any judgment calls at all about education and your choices around education. And yet we do have that kind of same feeling, or that feeling when it comes to family choices of, oh, but when you applaud people for getting married and raising kids, you're implicitly casting judgment. I don't think that's the case. I think that we can be adults here and figure out that, yes, there are good choices on average. Statistically, there are always going to be exceptions. I am still in touch with people I grew up around. Some of my friends by now, they've gotten married, they've gotten divorced. I know single parents. I love them. They're, you know, I'm close with them, and life is messy. People are complicated. I totally get it. But even they would say that, you know, in a, like, ideally and on average, it would be better, you know, to find a partner if you're going to have kids and raise them in that sort of intact home, because they lacked it. I lacked it. The people I grew up around didn't have that. And so we recognize its value.
So, yeah, it seems like very few people are making conscious decisions to destroy their homes or to sleep with someone and then have a baby with a dad that's not going to be there. I'm sure it happens, but it's often not a conscious decision. Any thoughts? And if you, like, these are tough questions, so if you don't know the answer to these, this is not necessarily need to be in your memoir, but on how best to go about, you mentioned sort of like cultural applauding it, but I mean, people aren't, they don't know the decisions that they're making. And so this is where I'm not advocating it, but like the religious impediment to any sex before marriage is a, like, yeah, you might think that you have the right person, but if you force them to commit in front of the entire community, chances that you stay together are better. Also, chances that you grow to resent each other at 60 years old while still together are higher. So it's not necessarily better. But yeah, just curious if you have any...
I think like there are ways to just... Yeah, the religious question is interesting, but I think we could find ways to just periodically and consistently remind people, right? Like, it's one of the, so sometimes I'll talk about this, like, yeah, if you're going to have kids, you know, and I'm not even saying like people should have kids, you know, the pronatalist, whatever, antinatalist question, like, I'm just, you know, I'm neutral on that. But if you're going to do it, I do think like you should be conscious and thoughtful and careful about how you approach it. And that kids would be better off with married parents. And sometimes people respond to this by saying, like, people already know that. Like, people know. Like, do you think anyone, like, yeah, does anyone plan into, oh, I'm going to have a kid and not, you know, talk to the child's other parent and, you know, raise the kid in this sort of fragmented family? No one thinks that way. We already know that. So why are you harping on it? And my response is usually, like, you can, like, know the information, but it's still helpful for it to be sort of drilled in repeatedly. In the same way that, like, I don't know, you drive on the freeway and, like, you see signs, click it or ticket, put your seatbelt on. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you might know to put your seatbelt on, but there is like a large percentage of the population that they do need that sort of regular reminders. You know, everyone knows by now cigarettes are bad for you. Every single pack of cigarettes still has the little warning label. Yeah. There are a lot of things we know that we won't act on. Knowledge alone isn't enough. You know, we all know that, you know, whatever, like, junk food is bad for you, but people will still get the fries instead of the side salad. In addition to the knowledge, it does help to have the periodic reminders and also the rewards, I think, around recognition and esteem and status. Yeah. And you know, to applaud people for making good choices and to make them feel good and hold that up as an example for other people. Yeah. So I think, like, in a way that is sort of reigniting the importance of these norms. You know, I've sometimes referred to it as like a social tax, that if you are an influential person, if you hold some amount of economic or cultural or political power, you know, you're recognized in some way for this influence. You know, you, like, I think you have some duty to pay that kind of social tax of, here are behaviors and habits and lifestyles that, yes, I know you kind of already know this, but let me just say it again. Let me reiterate it and remind people that this is an important sort of way to go, or a useful way for you to live your life. Mm. Yeah.
So you get out, you go to Cambridge, you hang out with all these rich folks. There's a number of things, and we chatted about luxury beliefs last time, but I'm curious, what don't the elite rich feel or understand about life for the poor? What is missed?
Yeah, I mean, so after the military, I went to Yale for undergrad and then Cambridge for grad school, and you know, I did an internship at Stanford, and like, I've kind of been in these, you know, selective academic institutions for almost a decade now, and not just interacting with students, but graduates now of these universities and professors and administrators and people, you know, affiliated with them. And what don't they understand? I think a lot of people who are well off, they have, like, there's almost this availability bias when you ask them to think about poverty. Mm-hmm. You know, they only think about the most kind of extreme and you know, like vivid images that appear in the media. So maybe prison inmates, mm-hmm. or homelessness or drug addiction. Very, very little do they think, you know, seldom do they think about, like, what a typical sort of poor working class person's life is like, of, you know, working minimum wage jobs, maybe multiple minimum wage jobs to make ends meet. When they think about crime, they conflate it with poverty. And it's true that crime is disproportionately committed by the poor, but that's not the same thing as saying most poor people commit crimes. Mm-hmm. Most poor people are law abiding and they actually don't like criminals because mm-hmm. they're the ones who live alongside them and have to bear the brunt of it, because criminals tend to target people who are around them, and it's usually other poor people. And I cite some statistics in the book that, you know, if you compare to a middle class American, the poorest Americans are 7 times more likely to be victims of aggravated assault, 7 times more likely to be victims of burglary, 20 times more likely to be victims of sexual assault. You know, if you're a poor person, you know, yes, you may be slightly more likely to become a perpetrator of crime, but you're vastly more likely to become a victim of crime. Mm. And I think a lot of rich people, upper middle class people, you know, they think, oh, you know, someone's committing a crime, it's fine, leave them alone. You know, they had a hard life, they're poor, but most of the people they're victimizing are the people around them. And those people are invisible, right? Like, you know, you very rarely see in the news a story of the victim of a crime, but you often see the mugshot of the perpetrator. And then when it comes to, like, pop culture, you know, there aren't that many. I guess there are. There are a couple of shows like The Bear or maybe Shameless. But, like, most of the time when you see stories of people who are financially struggling, oftentimes, you know, you see them turn into criminals. And that's just a more exciting story, a more interesting, appealing story, I think, of. And it's almost intuitive, I think, for a lot of upper middle class people that, you know, and maybe this is uncharitable to say, but I have had these private conversations with elite college graduates who tell me that, like, they totally understand, like, why someone would become a criminal, because they think the system is corrupt too. Mm-hmm. And that they would, you know, if they weren't in the position they were in, they would become unlawful in some way. But that's not how most people are. Most people aren't thinking in those terms. They want to, like, follow the law. They like police. They want sort of order and stability in their lives. And, you know, it's interesting. I just saw this study a couple of years ago now. And I, you know, to be clear, I haven't seen this replicated yet. So it's still, you know, tentative, the finding, which is that I mentioned that childhood instability variable earlier. And the study that I saw, it attempted to see if childhood instability had any relationship with political orientation. And there was a moderate and significant relationship with childhood instability and political conservatism. In other words, the more unstable your life as a child, the more likely you are to hold a conservative political attitude as an adult, sort of have a conservative temperament.
More unstable.
Yeah.
The more conservative.
Correct. Yeah. And this is just in the US context, and it's one study. It would still need to be replicated. But to me, it does make sense that if you measure the attitudes of educated, affluent people with high socioeconomic status, it's just a fact that they do, especially on social issues, tend to be more progressive in their orientation. Whereas people who have less education and less income and so on, they are generally more conservative or more conventional in their attitudes. And, you know, I cite some stats in the book about defund the police, for example. There were a couple of surveys in the U.S. in 2021, which found that the highest income Americans were the most in support of defunding the police. Yeah. The lowest income Americans were the least supportive decriminalizing drugs. I've met a lot of upper and upper middle class young people who think decriminalizing drugs is kind of like the prevailing attitude among the poor because they think, oh, like poor people use drugs, so let's just decriminalize it. But when you break down the survey data by education and income, the lowest income, least educated Americans are the least in support of decriminalizing drugs. Again, because they're the ones who see the squalor and the addiction and the chaos around them when people are free to use drugs, right? Like if you're an upper middle class person, drug use looks very different. It can look recreational. It can look like, you know,
there's expensive treatment facilities.
Yeah, exactly.
There's all sorts of things. Yeah.
Yeah. And probably in a lot of ways, you know, in terms of your personality and your temperament and in terms of how much resources you have, you know, you can find ways to do some drugs on the weekend recreationally.
Also, even the term drugs, I'm thinking, is like when they're not even thinking of the same compounds. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like when a poor person thinks of drugs, they might be thinking of fentanyl. They might be thinking of like
meth. Yeah.
When a rich person thinks of drugs, they're thinking of like
psychedelics,
MDMA and psilocybin. So it's funny that the baseline context for such a simple word, which I'm sure this occurs all over the place, they're not even thinking of the same reality. Yeah. So do you want to decriminalize drugs? It's like, well, they actually might agree or at least be indifferent. Like, but I think if you ask a rich person, should we decriminalize fentanyl? They'd be like, no.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And you know, the thing is, like, I think a lot of rich people, we use that as a shorthand, is like, you know, like rich people can get drugs anyway, you know, like whether they're legal or illegal, drugs aren't that hard to get, especially when you have money and connections. And so, you know, whether they're legal or not, I do think like it helps to introduce some friction so that, you know, because it's like I get like the kind of libertarian stance of, you know, a lot of young people, especially a lot of young guys, have this kind of libertarian attitude about personal choices. And I get it. Like, if you are an adult and, you know, you don't necessarily have special obligations or whatever, you're just a sort of self-sufficient person, autonomous person, and you want to do drugs in the privacy of your own home, whatever, like, okay, sure. But once you legalize drugs, that's not the only type of person who's going to be doing them. There are going to be people like, you know, mothers of children will be doing drugs or kids, teenagers, people who aren't fully functional, autonomous, self-driven adults, right?
That's the hard thing that you're saying right there is like the recognition, which I think is true, is that we have people, many of whom are above the age of 18 by a far margin, who are not adults. And I mean that in the like emotionally mature way. So it's like on the one hand, you don't want to condescend and be like, I know what's best for you. I'm going to limit your choices like I would a child. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the consequences of not condescending to people who have not had the formative evolution to like go to being like, I can think into how this will impact my future experiences, and I can intuit how it might affect the people around me, and I might all of these other consequences, that second, third order effects that they could imagine. How do you deal with a nation or any sort of community of people that the people are not capable yet of behaving like adults? And this is where I get nervous, because you get anti-democratic sentiment that arises, which says, I know how to, I'm the captain of this boat. You guys are all just sailors. Let me captain the ship, versus every individual deserves, you know, the right to self-autonomy, which I guess is the more libertarian take on it. I don't have an answer, but yeah. It just seems like a tension that I sense the point of both sides of.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, you know, we you always have to make trade-offs. And in this case, you know, I do think that, you know, we should be thinking, and yeah, you know, one of the points of my book is thinking about the lives of young children. And sometimes you do have to sacrifice a bit of freedom for the benefit of people who aren't mature and aren't developed and aren't sophisticated enough. And yeah, if that means limiting access to drugs or finding ways to introduce friction so that people like my birth mother wouldn't be able to get drugs when they have small children, something like that, I think that would be a good thing. And yeah, it's like either way, like the whatever solution is going to be imperfect. And it like regardless of the path you choose, whatever policy is implemented, poor people will disproportionately be affected. So if drugs are decriminalized, you're going to get more overdose.
Hi, I'm Sean Nelson, founder and CEO of Lovesack and host of the Let Me Save You 25 Years podcast. Want to avoid common pitfalls and get straight to the insights that drive success? Join me and recognize names like John Mackey of Whole Foods and Joe DeSena of Spartan as we unpack the hard-earned lessons from their journeys. Ready to streamline your path to success? Listen to Let Me Save You 25 Years on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Let Me Save You 25 Years with Sean Nelson. Listen now.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy. But being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care. And BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
Doses, and most of those overdoses are going to be poor people, people living on the margins of society, people from historically mistreated backgrounds, and so on. But if you legalize, or rather, if you criminalize drugs, then you know who's going to be arrested, who's going to be locked up, who's going to be you know, pursued by law enforcement. Again, people who are marginalized and so on, and poor and dispossessed. Either way, but then the question is, which of those will fewer people suffer? Will fewer poor people suffer if decriminalization of drugs is implemented versus criminalization? And in my view, I think keeping them criminalized, limiting access and so on, I think that would be best both for people and then for the kids in those neighborhoods and so on, even though it's going to be, you know, imperfect too. So, I was going to say something else about this decriminalization point around drugs, but the captain of the ship point. So on this point around foster care, you know, I grew up in the foster homes. This was in the 90s and early 2000s, and I just saw this report in NPR, which found that the number of foster kids who have entered the system in the U.S. as a result of parental drug use has doubled since the year 2000. So basically doubled since I was a kid in the system. And the system was already pretty bad when I was in. I can only imagine how overburdened it is. And so this article in NPR cited things like the opioid crisis, like things, you know, since then, you know, things have gotten worse. Drugs have become even more easily accessible in many ways due to prescriptions and fentanyl and so on. And so, yeah, I mean, okay, like, you're just going to have more kids in the system, more kids who are suffering, more families that are suffering.
I think intervention at every level is valuable. I'm always curious to try to get as deep to the level of like, what is the cause here? So we've talked about drugs. I could also think of, not that it like unplanned pregnancy and disrupted families. I think people in similar conversations, we haven't touched on it, but like the effects of social media on people's lives and the choices that it makes them have. It seems to me, I do think that there is truth to the common root of some sort of deep, deep disconnection that we feel with ourselves, either spiritually, as a community. I'm curious if that resonates with you. And if not, feel free to throw it back or out.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say because, so if you look at some of the data shared by people like Jonathan Haidt in his recent book, The Anxious Generation, or Jean Twenge, I think her last name, they share all of these charts and figures indicating that if you look at young people now, fewer young people report using drugs or drinking or driving, getting their driver's licenses. I mean, all of the sort of classic milestones of adolescence and early adulthood are on the decline among young people. Fewer fights, fewer young people are having sex. Like, you know, all these kinds of things that, you know, do you want teenagers using drugs and having sex and getting into fights? Maybe not. But then the reasoning seems to be, at least, you know, according to Haidt and Jean Twenge and some other researchers, is social media, like you mentioned. So these young people are going online, you know, the parties on Snapchat, the parties on Instagram or TikTok. And so, like, what's weird to me, like, this is just totally anecdotal, but I remember when I was a teenager in my early 20s, even if like you didn't have anything going on the weekend, you still felt this need to, like, if people ask you, what are you doing this Saturday? Oh, hanging out with friends, party, you know, like you still had to put on this show of like, yeah, I got an active social life. I've noticed now with young people, they're perfectly fine just saying like, yeah, just chilling at home, you know, just hanging out. And like, they just feel much more comfortable not at least giving this facade of an active social life. And I think that's just because, like, when you say hanging at home, people kind of know, oh, you're going to be on social media, you're going to be chatting, you know, they'll infer that, you'll still be connected in some way. And so I think, like, weirdly, we've sort of traded maybe one pathology for another.
Yeah, that's my sense.
Yeah, that, like, it's not great, like, for 17-year-olds to be doing what I was doing, but it's also not great for them to just be sort of cooped up in their house, not really interacting. There was one chart I saw the other day, the amount of face-to-face time teenagers have with friends. It used to be 2 hours per day in the early 2000s, and now it's dropped to less than 1 hour per day. And I mean, that's a massive decline, like more than half. And now, yeah, what are young people doing just on social media? And it's a different form of addiction in a way. And so,
and some of them are more evidently destructive. Like, I've definitely, there is value to trading out one pathology for one that is perhaps less harmful. So if it's like, okay, if one response to this crisis is to bring a gun into school, and another response is to drink a lot, and another response is to bury your head in your phone, like, we might be like, okay, there are preferable ones here. A short story that I was just reminded of as you were talking was, I'm at the gym and I'm sitting in a machine, a leg thing, and the guy's, I don't know, I'm doing leg presses, he's doing whatever, and he's probably 15, and with no shame, and I know I would have felt this, he just gets his thing out and starts doing this, and I'm 2 feet away from him.
Yeah.
And I was,
I love that.
I was stunned by the complete, like, I used to feel that I had to have a pretense of reality to the photos that I took, and to invite in someone witnessing my vanity in that way would be unthinkable to me.
Yeah.
I was like, look, I had to pretend that I didn't see it, and, you know, but that he felt so comfortable doing that, and he did it the whole time. And I was just like, oh, wow, this is a different generation.
Yeah.
But also, he does not even feel that there is a distinction between how he looks and how he is. Like, what I'm saying is, there was a level at which when I was doing that, I was like, I know that I am one way, and this is just me trying to look a certain way. And for him, that schism doesn't even seem to be felt, and therefore there's nothing to be ashamed of, to like be so flagrantly inauthentic. And I was struck by that at
it used to be, you know, you'd be in the real world and then you'd sort of go on the computer and go online, and now we're always online, and to take a break from online we go into the real world, right? And now those two things have just more and more integrated. And I've seen those things too, of just like, at the gym or in public, of like people just sort of openly like putting on a show for their camera, live streaming, what have you. And we've, like, I guess attention now has sort of maybe become the main drug mm-hmm. of choice.
Yeah. That's well said. And I think, yeah. and I think it might have less immediately and easily traceable destructive impacts, but I think the inner emptiness
yeah.
is very similar to the emptiness that is treated by alcohol or fighting or something else. Yeah. And I think it, yeah, it's better because it's not as destructive as those things, but there's still like this deep, deep hole that makes me.
Yeah. And there's no obvious consequence to it, right? Like if you drink enough, like I did, maybe you'll end up in rehab. I mean, hopefully you don't die, but yeah, if you drink and drive on the road, like you will get pulled over, maybe spend a night in jail, what have you. Like there are sort of recognizable moments of like, okay, I've been involved in this really bad habit and I've taken it too far. Now I need to recognize and course correct. Whereas, yeah, seeking attention and likes, like there's no sort of stopping point of, oh, I need to stop this or I've run into a brick wall here. I need to, you know, sort of reorganize my life. Yeah. And it also just like, you know, from like an aesthetic point of view, I just think it's like, and maybe this is sort of my teenage self talking, but I just think it's less cool. like when I see teenage boys vaping, I'm like, you got to smoke a cigarette, man. Like, be a man. Like, smoke
this
a cigarette.
Is like those old heads that wear like leather though and think that we were lame for wearing skinny jeans.
Yes, exactly.
They've got like their, the
but
dead
I just
heads.
Think it's like, it's too easy now. Like when I see kids like drinking the vanilla infused vodka.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, back in the day, I had to like sneak tequila from my friend's mom's
cabinet.
There's
no way I was going to drink a cranberry vodka. Yeah, no
exactly.
way.
Now there's no shame in it. Like, yeah, just, you had to like, there was a bit of like, and it's funny, I don't remember if I mentioned this in the book or not, but as a kid, you know, like the first, probably like the first 70 cigarettes I smoked, I hated it. I thought it was disgusting. Like I thought like, you know, just like tasted bad, but I wanted to look cool for my friends. There was like this barrier to entry. And now I almost wonder like, you know, okay, kids aren't smoking cigarettes as much. I don't know the data on vaping, but vaping is like, it's pleasant, man. It tastes good. It's like flavored, it's infused with whatever. And like, you know, I do think like maybe having that like a little bit of a barrier may actually have deterred kids from smoking, whereas now vaping has become more appealing in some ways.
Yeah.
Same with drinking. Yeah.
We've been able to really mitigate the effects or the immediate effects of disconnection. Is one of the things. And that's sort of the trend that I'm seeing here. I think of a friend of a, I'll keep it vague. I'll never get caught for this. A friend of a friend had a baby, is a woman who had a baby and was Instagramming the whole, not the birth, but like everything. And the infant daughter is now modeling immediately. The sense that I get when this is shared with me and I see these things is very much that the daughter is operating as an accessory to, and it's not to say that there's not love there, but there is a parent like, oh, look how much I love her. And I'm like dressing her up in these little outfits, but there is a real lack of attunement from mother to daughter that is going on there. And it seems like we've been able to smooth over the immediate apparent disconnection that we have with one another that used to become evident in fights that you would physically have with your neighbor, but are still managing to disconnect from one another in a way that leads to increased self-harm, you know, and all of these other sorts of things. So trending better, and I wouldn't go back and do it the other way, but still pathological.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, the data that I mentioned earlier from Height and others about, you know, rising rates of anxiety, depression,
self-harm, exactly.
Suicide attempts, I think for boys and girls are on the rise. And, you know, in some ways I wonder if like, you know, just living your life online, constantly being judged in that way of like losing attunement with your body, of like going out into the world and doing things, you know, sort of testing where the boundaries are, what you're capable of, your limits, like there's always going to be an inherent aspect of danger there. You know, don't go as far as maybe my friends and I did, but maybe somewhere between where kids are now, where like, you know, I don't remember the specific percentage here, but you know, something like less than 50% of 17-year-olds have driver's licenses now. And this is like a massive decline compared to 10 years ago, like fewer and fewer young people even want to drive. And, you know, I saw this article in the Wall Street Journal and, you know, they asked a few teenagers, like, why don't you have your license? What's going on? A lot of them are just like, I don't want to bother, or like, it seems kind of scary. It seems kind of dangerous. And it's like,
Scary, yeah, dangerous.
I remember, when I was 15, getting my learner's permit, driving was a little bit kind of anxiety inducing mm-hmm. and first time on the road and whatever. But like through the process of doing that, you learn a bit of self-mastery and some command, and you gain some maturity and some respect, and you feel that sense of autonomy. And I think like it's a very basic thing, getting a license, but but compared to not getting it, right? Like of just never knowing that you're capable of doing that, I think that can also introduce or maybe feed into the self-doubt that already coincides with adolescence.
Yeah.
You know, like part of going from, you know, that awkward phase of adolescence of insecurity and self-consciousness and self-doubt and constantly worrying about how you appear in the eyes of others is, yeah, by like reaching those traditional milestones of getting a license, maybe getting a part-time job, of, you know, doing an internship, or just sort of doing something in the real world, of sort of overcoming these small obstacles. And yeah, fewer and fewer kids are, you know, doing that.
The stakes also seem, I've spoken to kids who are, they're adults now, but they're like, say, 13 years younger than me. They're 23. They're in their, like, they're content creators. Yeah. And the level of fear that they carry of saying the wrong thing. Some person that I know said, for instance, that he thought that it doesn't matter. He said nothing offensive. And he admitted that he's still like, it keeps him up at night that somebody would dig this video up.
Okay.
And find him saying this nothing offensive comment on, like, it's not even worth saying. The risks seem to, the sense of risk that kids experience seems to have been jacked through the roof of being canceled or shunned or locked out of society. And if you go back to our generation and the generation before, it was just like, there was way, way more risk tolerated and encouraged. And yes, bad things happened as a result of it, like more kids probably broke their arms or whatever, but the consequences of a risk afraid generation, I think, have, well, probably ours is worse than our parents. And I guess we'll be finding it out over the next several decades.
I think you and I are almost the same age, and came of age. We were already basically adults or teenagers when social media took off. Whereas now, young people, they go their whole lives online, right? Like, I don't know, you open up your first Instagram when you're 12 or 13 and like everything is online and you've never known a world without it. And so, sometimes I wonder if like that too is maybe why like fewer young people have friends. Is just part of friendship is like taking risks, right? Mm-hmm. Like saying things that may be borderline offensive or mocking or teasing. And if a lot of your interaction is through text, like you have screenshots, you have you have the receipts.
And it's scalable. Like bullying can happen at scale. Ostracization can happen at scale. All of a sudden, it used to just be like whoever you could tell. And now it's whoever you can send it to.
Yeah. And so now you just have to, constantly walk on eggshells like this person you're describing of, oh, did I say something offensive? Could this be used against me? Could this be held against me? And now you have like stories of this actually happening, of people leaking screenshots of group chats or what have you, and kids getting their like college admissions letters rescinded because they said something offensive or what have you. And so now it's just everyone is like, there's like this chilling effect of people don't want to risk getting too or saying the wrong thing. But like part of how you build social bonds is like taking risks and saying things that may be borderline offensive, because, you know, that's just part of how relationships work. So I mean, all of this, if we could find ways to just bring young people together in, you know, meet space in reality and get off the phones and...
What are you interested in these days?
It's a good question. I mean, what am I interested in? So, you know, in terms of like daily life, I've been promoting the book, running my Substack full time. I just wrote this post. So I recently got this columnist position at the Boston Globe, and I wrote this piece. You may have seen this actually. Some of the data, it was going around on social media, of the gender polarization, this sort of increasing gap between young men and young women in terms of their political orientation, such that among people who are under 30, young women are becoming much more left-leaning in their political affiliation. And for young men, it's either remain stable or they're kind of veering more to the right. And so what's happening here? Why are they, why is there this growing divergence? 10 years ago, 20 years ago, the gap was much smaller between men and women. And in this article, I suggested drawing on this idea from the gender equality paradox, that what may be happening here is that, you know, the younger generation, they were born into a society where we have prized equality as an ideal and as a policy goal more so than at any previous point in history. And so the gender equality paradox, you know, the short version of it is that when researchers attempt to measure gender differences in various societies, they find that the differences between men and women are largest in the societies that are the most equal. So if you look at places like Denmark and Sweden and Norway, the Netherlands, the gender differences between men and women in terms of their academic interests, in terms of their personality traits, even physicality in terms of height and weight, BMI, blood pressure, the differences between men and women are the largest in those societies, and they're actually smaller in societies that explicitly treat men and women differently. So in places like Swaziland or Brazil or China or other countries that are less equal. And so all of this is to say, like, okay, so now we're seeing in the US and other Western countries, women and men are just becoming more different along another dimension, which would be politics. And so this is my sort of throwing my hat in the ring, because there are so many competing explanations for this. What's going on? Why are young men and women drifting apart so much politically?
This is the meme, by the way, where it's like, if it says centrist on his Tinder, that means conservative.
Yeah, we could jump into that too, because I've heard this from a bunch of younger friends, especially like young Zoomer males who are on the apps.
Conservative, because those you get. Yeah.
Well, they'll put moderate.
Sorry, that's the word. Yeah. Moderate.
They'll put moderate, but that just means they're a closet Republican or closet conservative. And I find this interesting too, that, I'd be curious your take on this. Like, why is it that men seem to be more, so like, you know, if you look at like the personality traits, if you look at sort of, and even just the stereotypes of men versus women, men tend to be more disagreeable, more confrontational, more rebellious, what have you. And yet when it comes to politics, it's actually men who are more coy and more fearful and less forthcoming about their political views. Yeah. Whereas women, you know, there's no shyness, you know, on the apps. I'm assuming, you know, women, they will just say they're progressive or left-leaning or liberal or whatever. And when men and women go out on dates, it's the man who's like, I'm kind of like, you know, and it's the women who are like very happy to talk about their politics. And that one, I actually haven't wrapped my head around why that is the case.
When I think through it right now, it seems that in most other domains, when you take a risk, there's an opportunity for an outsized reward. So like if you start a business, you might fail, but you might have $1 billion. And there's outsized rewards. That is not at play when declaring your political allegiance. So you declare that you're a liberal, you get nothing for it. That's like table stakes for some of these women to swipe on you. And by the way, I think this is mostly in the Tinder space.
Yeah.
I think it washes out if a woman meets you and is attracted to you. I've watched it happen where like the biggest American flag wearing dude, you know, has no issue with women that just yesterday in their gender studies class espoused that they would never. But when it's a swipe, I think it's very easy. And I think there's nothing to be gained in it. And so it's like, okay, well, if there's nothing to be gained, I'm going to be a little bit coy about it. I'll say moderate because I can only lose through this declaration.
Okay, so there's almost like an unconscious, like game theory approach here of like if you declare you're a Republican or conservative up front, then you may lose out on a bunch of matches. But if you say moderate, you may actually get a wider pool of potential matches. And then from there, if you get them on a date and get to know each other, then you can sort of slowly reveal your true views.
You could probably immediately reveal it. I mean, I know a guy who was just like, I write moderate, and I just tell him like I'm voting for Trump. But it's, you know, like there's a, and he does fine, because I think there are, this is not judgmental, but this is, I think this is my view of it. I don't think that there's a deep sincerity to a lot of these beliefs. I think these are socially convenient statements that are made by a lot of the younger generation. And I think if the wind blows in the other direction, you'll watch them flip. Versus, I think there are other beliefs that, like, when people are deeply religious, for instance, and the wind blows against it, they're like, I'm not moving. But is it time for a black square, or is it time for this? Or is, I think that is,
Ukrainian flag, or
I think it's a sign of social allegiance, and the sincerity is to the social, what do I have to do to be included in this group? And it is not to any of the particular signifiers that I've attached myself to.
Yeah. It's more about the group than the cause or the movement. It's more about acceptance than any particular belief. That makes sense. That would, that fits here.
Just of how quickly I see these, and this is very anecdotal, but like the social media loudness give way to an in-person total acquiescence for a guy that they view as high status or high value.
I see. Yeah, where they'll just kind of they're flexible in terms of what they're willing to
believe. They declare a lack of flexibility and live flexibly, which is and again, totally anecdotal, totally, but match, you know, consistent. And then there are some, to the credit, who are just not, you know, some that are like dyed in the wool. This is important. If you don't say it, get the fuck out of, you know, my space. I definitely don't want to date you.
I see.
But I think that there's a large contingent of followers in that generation.
Interesting.
That's just a sense, though.
No, that sounds right. Like the whole dynamic around the interaction between politics and dating right now, and there seems to be a lot of animosity between young men and young women too. And hey, it's just so strange, like this conflict, because like, you know, like men and women like naturally like each other, but somehow with social media, with all these like sort of perverse incentive structures, like saying outrageous and horrible things about the opposite sex just gets, you know, you're sort of, you're seeking those rewards, right? Like there's the reward of like getting a partner, getting a romantic partner and settling down, or finding someone you like. But then there's also the reward of like trashing the opposite sex and getting tons of likes and basking in the dopamine and the attention and the accolades of the online world. And I do what, like if people are sort of like memeing themselves into actually believing some of this nonsense.
Yeah, I wonder if it's, is that different nowadays? I don't know enough historically to say if it's evolved or not, but it is, the sense that it makes to me is that a lot of the wounding in your young life is going to come in your dating, in your relationships. And it's very easy to go men, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's because it is, it's all men for you. You know what I mean? And if you're a guy, it's like easy to go girls, you're women. And because everyone that has ever broken your heart, they got one thing in common. But it's also to watch people self-select out of circumstances where they might be much more fulfilled. So that's just another internet lore. I'm like, there's a, do you know the Fresh and Fit podcast?
I've heard of it.
So it's got a quality of like shitting on women where they get they live. So anyway, they live in Miami, and the one guy is asked, because he's talking about how girls just want to go on yachts and they just want to do all this kind of stuff. And so he's asked, what percentage of women do you think are like going on a yacht now? And he said 40%. And it's just if you live in a Miami club and you spend all your time at the VIP section, it might be a sample of 40% of those women are going on yachts. And you could make the seemingly reasonable deduction that 40% of women are going on yachts for Yacht Week, except this is not a reflection of women. This is a reflection of where you choose to spend your time.
That's fascinating.
And so I think that the same thing is happening when I hear these declarations about men, is like, you do not realize that you're actually telling on yourself here. And when you're declaring about women, you don't realize you're talking about yourself a lot of times, where you hang out, where you refuse to hang out, the types of women you refuse to look at in court.
This is like a sort of a classic like cognitive bias. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have read Thinking Fast and Slow and how the late Daniel Kahneman wrote about how, people will, they're very happy to sort of take their anecdotal experiences and then generalize them. You know,
as I've done several times on this podcast.
And like it's a very natural human thing, right? Like that's one of the points of the book, is like, you know, these are sort of heuristics we rely on, and most of the time they work. Right. But then there are cases like when it comes to like 50% of the population, you know, it's very difficult to make sort of sweeping generalizations on half the population in that way.
Especially if it's causing you internal aggravation, pain, suffering, and you know.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. That people will they'll generalize the particular, right? So you have this interaction, mm-hmm. maybe a few of these interactions, and then you'll generalize them. But people are very bad at particularizing the general. In other words, if you learn something in a piece of research or a study, like, so let's say you say, okay, 0.03% of women have been on a yacht. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard for people to like learn that information, then actually apply it in their lives.
And see that.
Right. Yeah. And see that and make that connection and realize there's this whole world that you're not seeing. Yeah. You see whatever, you live in Miami and you're seeing women on a boat or something, but like there's a whole, like, you know, whatever, 99 point whatever percent of women who aren't. And it's hard for you to sort of integrate that information because it's so at odds with your personal experiences.
Yeah.
And I think like, yeah, a lot of this, you know, like, you know, some guys will say things like, you know, women will, what is it like? I heard this young guy say the other day, women don't want boyfriends. They just want attention, something like that. And again, like you're saying, he's saying something about himself, right? Not something about women. Like maybe he went on a couple of dates and they didn't go anywhere. And he just like leapt to this conclusion that, oh, these women.
And he's posting this on social media, I imagine, right?
No. He said this in real life.
Oh, in real life.
Yeah, yeah. And, but yeah, he went on a few bad dates and this is sort of his takeaway. But he's not thinking about how, like, I don't know, there was a Pew study recently that came out about this, which is also really interesting, which that the majority of women under 30 have a partner of some kind, boyfriend, husband, whatever. Like they report that they are not single, the majority of women. So obviously they don't just want attention, right? Like the majority of women are in relationships. In contrast, something like, I think it's something like 60, 65% of young guys are not in relation, or yes, that's right. 65% of men roughly. Young men under 30 are single. They're not in relationships. And so, you know, I can imagine like a lot of these young single guys, and it's growing over time, the number of young guys who report being single, not in a relationship. Maybe they've gone on a couple of bad dates. And I think it's really hard on a young male, like the ego on the, especially when you don't have much going on in your life. Like, I don't know if you've had this experience personally, but like I've found like, like as you get older, as you know, like when you're 20 or 22,
nobody
as
wants
a guy,
anything to do with you.
Yeah. You don't got much going on. Like you don't have much in the way of career success.
Men
or
don't
want
to be with you. Women don't want to be with you. Yeah. Like and speaking to my girlfriend, I was like, I don't think you get being a 19-year-old man. Cause you never like you leapt into desirability in your life. And you were wanted by people with power and people who could get you the table. And you were invited into the thing before you were 21. Yeah. Let me tell you, I was not. You know what I mean? And I remember it. There's something beautiful about it because the feedback you get from people is, and this is the point that I think young men are tapping into, it's what value do you bring and provide? Because you have none inherently. You know what I mean? Like people do respond to you in that way when you're a young man. And it trains this skill building, value bringing ethos, which I think I've had to debunk in my own life. Like, oh, I do have inherent value as a person.
Yeah. Right.
But I do think that that is a thing that the flip side for women is after they come out of their, like, I guess you could say most fertile, eligible years, if they haven't found a thing, they then see the downside of that, of like, now you're not wanted in your late 30s after this. Now people are treating you only based on the skills and value or whatever that you bring. And that can be a painful and rude awakening for someone who after puberty was like very quickly wanted by the head basketball player 2 years older than them. But that is just not something that happens for young men. It is a later curve in terms of like anyone wanting to associate with you.
Yeah. It's very different. The experiences of men and women in that regard, in the sort of romantic realm, right? Like for young men, if you're 20 something, early 20s, late teens, and you kind of know you don't have much going on in your life and then you get rejected a couple of times, it just makes you angry, right? Because you're already kind of at the bottom and then you sort of take a couple of more, like inflict a couple of more blows to your ego. And it's like, yeah, some of these guys go a little bit overboard, but most of them bounce back. But then as you get older and acquire a little bit of success and a little bit of experience and a bit of, you know, you just become more attractive over time. Like as you know, assuming you make self-improvement a goal in your life, by the time you reach your late 20s, early 30s, things usually do improve. And then you get rejected and it's not as bad because you know, like you've, you know, maybe you've done some of the inner work too, right? Like, you know that you are inherently worthy as a person, but then you can kind of like look around at your life, like, well, I've done things and like, okay, this didn't work out, but like probably someone will like me, right? Like I've done pretty well. Like this particular woman wasn't a big fan, but, or whatever, she didn't like me, but someone else will probably find something in my life to, you know, be interested in. So yeah, I think like that's like an important message that I think a lot of guys aren't really getting, from, I don't know, parents or society or sources or whatever. And like more and more, they're more sort of withdrawing into video games or porn or the online world.
That it gets better, you're saying.
Yeah, that it does get better.
If you apply yourself, it gets. And this is where I think Andrew Tate has found a tremendous amount of success. Yes. Is the, no one gives a shit about you. Mm-hmm. And again, these are, it's a harsh and provocative way of putting what there are, there is truth. Is like people don't give a shit about men, which I think you could take a view of it that says that is true. It is not the same with women. You're going to have to make something of yourself. You're going to have to apply yourself. It's going to hurt and it's going to be worth it to do. And so I think like that Jordan Peterson filled a similar space years earlier of clean up your room, take responsibility, go out and do things. And I was thinking this earlier in the conversation, though I didn't mention it. I'm very into like the internal psychology and how it manifests itself socially. But the absence of a, like there's a lot of wounded masculinity and the absence of that healthy masculinity that says it's okay to struggle. You can do it. I believe in you. I'm not going to do it for you. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like all of those sorts of things, versus that this Jonathan Haidt talks about this generation that seems to have that smothering mother, which is like, it's not fair what they did to you. You should have gotten first place. This is not supposed to be this hard. This world is not supposed to be this mean. Don't worry about it. If it makes you upset, don't stretch or push into it. And definitely both, there's a healthy version of the feminine that I don't think that is, but the absence of that healthy cultural masculine thing is felt and is exemplified by the rush when an Andrew Tate shows up of that gravitational energy that he has, even though I think there are aspects of how he does it that are deeply, deeply toxic and unhealthy.
What I don't like the word toxic, about him is unhealthy. Like, you know, like the whole controversy swirling around him, like I view him like I've never met him. I don't know, like anything beyond like some clips that I've seen online. But to me, he just seems like a character. And he almost seems like the role that like rappers played when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember being a teenager and like, young boys looked up to people like, I don't know, like Jay-Z or 50 Cent or Eminem. And like, they, you know, in a way they were characters too. They were drawing on real life personal experiences in their music and in their public personas. And of course, like there was all kinds of like outrage among parents and how horrible these rappers were and how they were corrupting the youth and so on. I'm viewing Andrew Tate and I'm like, like obviously he says horrible things, but like there is that energy and
there's
that magnetism.
There's something to what you're saying for sure.
And I think like he's just like, he's an influencer, right? Like he's like almost the modern day version of that like famous rapper who like kind of exaggerates and embellishes and says things that are, you know, they have a maybe a kernel of truth, but like surrounded by a bunch of stuff that like to make it extra provocative and jarring to, you know, modern young sensibilities or something. But yeah, like I kind of get the appeal, like especially now when things are so much more sanitized, I think they were than they used to be. And all of the kinds of sensitivities and people seem delicate. And then you have suddenly this brash, bold person who, you know, I think I can see the appeal.
I think parents take things very literally. I think back to like being a kid and Eminem coming out and people were incensed about the lyrics. It's like, he says he's going to kill her, you know, like he says he's going to stab her with a machete. And it was, that was not the message that I was receiving from it at the time, even though I was listening to the same lyrics. It was like, he's dangerous and cool.
Yeah, exactly.
And at no point was I like gonna kill my ex-wife, you know, based on that. And it was the same outrage with Grand Theft Auto, which is like they're beating up prostitutes. And it's like there was not a moment in my life that I thought that would be a cool thing to do, but it was dangerous and transgressive and for that reason fun. So there is like this real literalness that adults seem to forget that like teens don't have. They're like, they're tapped into the vibe and the energy and the coolness of it.
Now, all this being said, like, I do think there is space. Like, I think it's in a way, like, I think it's good that parents do.
Yeah, totally.
Him. Like to hold that line of like, because in a way,
it's a good tension.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You need that tension because you need something to press against mm-hmm. as a kid. You need that. And if parents are shutting, like,
if there's nothing, yeah, exactly. You're going to find it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're just going to keep going further and further until you reach that point. So, you know, like, yeah, I think it's good that, like, you know, these like Gen X and boomer parents are freaking out and whatever. It's like, it's fine. You know,
Dungeons and Dragons in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, something. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, let me do my little plug. This is Troubled by my friend Rob. I read the whole thing. It's really good. I was touched at a number of occasions. We didn't tell any of the stories that were most impactful, but quite frankly, they weren't even the most harrowing. They were just, for whatever reason, ones that stuck with me. And the Miss Martinez in the pool one. I don't know why, but I'll tell it really quickly. And so you guys can decide if this is something you want to check out, but I'll set it up. You can tell it. How about that?
All right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sure.
You're picked up by Mrs. Martinez. Mm-hmm. She is a woman who seemingly collects young foster boys, but not the older ones because they don't do the chores like they're told. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You are instructed to clean the pool. You've never really gotten to be in a pool before. And one day you finish chores early and she lets you get in the pool for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So this was actually out here in LA in El Monte, I want to say. And this was the final foster home I lived in LA, seventh foster home. And yeah, they had this pool in the back. It wasn't a big pool, but you know, like a medium sized pool. And, you know, I'd asked her multiple times if I could go swimming, if she would teach me to swim, if I could get in the water. And she always said no. And then one day, you know, it's like, I'd go to school and then I do a bunch of chores and then I just go to bed exhausted. And that was kind of like the routine. But one day she says, it was like a Saturday afternoon, you can get in the pool. And she instructs me to stay on one side of the pool only. And, you know, again, like I had this sort of oppositional thing. And as a kid of like, okay, this adult told me to do something. And now I'm curious. And now
there was no understanding as to why.
No, I didn't know why. I'm just like, this is, and it also just sounded dumb to me because she didn't tell me, right? She's just like, stay on that side. And I'm like, I want to see that other side. Like, I want to know what's going on the other side of the pool. I want to, you know, and so I, you know, sort of drift over. And then suddenly, like, you know, I didn't know there was a deep end.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's this sort of steep decline and I lose my footing and now I'm, you know, slowly starting to drown and I can't catch my breath. And, you know, I'm like trying to, you know, basically treading water and keeping my head above. And Mrs. Martinez, she's on the phone and she sees me and she can kind of see what's going on and she continues on the phone. And eventually after maybe what felt like an eternity was probably more realistically, maybe 45 seconds, a minute, she grabs the pool rake that I was using to clean the pool and, you know, extends it outward, still on the phone, and, you know, pulls it out and I grab onto it and she pulls me in and, you know, I get out of the pool and I start coughing and I've swallowed a bunch of this chlorinated water and I'm spitting it out. And, you know, she hangs up the phone and says, you know, something like, you know, that's what you get for not listening to me. Next time I'll just let you drink up the whole pool. And she was a very, cold woman. And, you know, like I think about this, about how, you know, she would take like boys, you know, roughly age 7 to 9 and, you know, rake the leaves, clean the gutters, feed the dogs, clean the pool, all these little chores she had around the house. And, you know, I remember one day I asked her, why do we have all these chores? Why do I have to do all these things around the house? And she said, it's to keep me out of trouble because there were a lot of other sort of bad kids in the neighborhood, kept me, you know, away from them or taking up a lot of my time. And even with all these chores, I did still sometimes find time on the weekends to go hang out with the other kids and the other boys around there. But yeah, it was, you know, that was probably that was a hard memory to write about. Mm-hmm. And you're not the first person to say like, that was one of the stories that stood with you. You know, you mentioned, you know, there's a possibility this book will be adapted into a film. And speaking with the producers, they also mentioned, you know, like putting something like this.
That's so incredible. I think that people, I appreciate that you dove into your own pain in order to share it. It's resonant, you know, and I felt that, and I'm not, and it makes total sense that they did as well. So
yeah. Well, yeah, I appreciate it, man. Yeah.
Beautiful. If you guys want to check it out, it's called Troubled. Thank you guys. Peace.